You're listening to WMFO in Medford. My name is Chris Earle. Normally it's Watch This from 5 to 7 on Wednesday nights, but I'm bringing back story time for you for the fall. So special story time for you here today until 7 p.m. So get yourself a cup of cocoa and kick your feet up, maybe a lemonade or a beer, whatever. Story time here with you until 7 p.m. Oh, you're going to enjoy this.
Hello, children. Hello. Here is this morning's story. Are you ready? Then we'll begin. One day, Ricky the Magic Pixie went to visit Daisy Bumble in her tumble-down cottage. He found her in the bedroom. Roughly, he grabbed her heavy shoulders, pulling her down onto the bed and ripping off her... Old Nick, the sea captain, was a rough, tough, jolly sort of fellow. He loved the life of the sea, and he loved to hang out down by the pier, where the men dressed as ladies. Rumpeltweezer ran the Dinky Tinky shop in the foot of the magic oak tree, by the wobbly dum-dum bush, in the shade of the magic glade, down in Dingley Dell. Here he sold contraceptives and... Discipline. Naked. With a melon.
This is the story of Lady and the Tramp. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the chimes ring like this. Let's begin now. One snowy Christmas, Darling received a very special gift from her husband. She unwrapped the brightly wrapped box, and out popped a beautiful little puppy.
Oh, Jim, dear, she's beautiful. I think I'll call her Lady.
Lady had found a very happy home with Darling and Jim, dear. Her afternoons were spent playing in the park with Darling. And later, she would race Jim, dear, home from work. One summer day, Jim, dear, came home with a surprise for Lady.
Here you are, girl. Your very own collar and license. Why don't you show them off to Jock and Trusty?
Lady trotted proudly next door to see the neighboring dogs.
Notice anything different, Trusty?
Why, Miss Lady, drawled the aging bloodhound, you've got a new collar.
Jock the Scotty added,
Aye, and it looks very expensive.
Later that summer, Lady noticed a change in Jim, dear, and Darling. The races home stopped, as did the afternoon walks. Instead, Darling just sat home and knitted. Poor lonely Lady sat outside and wondered why her owners were acting so strangely. The answer came a few weeks later. There was tremendous excitement in the house. Jim Deere happily telephoned his Aunt Sarah.
It's here! And it's a baby! A boy! I'm a daddy!
Lady tiptoed upstairs and peeked carefully into a frilly crib.
Oh, it's the cutest little human I've ever seen. So this is why Jim, dear, and Darling were acting so strangely.
Lady rushed outside to tell Jock and Trusty about the beautiful baby. As she talked, a stray dog with no collar or license entered the yard. He sauntered right up to Lady.
Hello, Pigeon. I couldn't help overhearing your conversation, and I think you're all wrong. Why, babies are just cute little bundles of trouble.
Jock had heard about this intruder. His name was Tramp, and he always managed to escape the dog catcher's net. Jock didn't like it.
Off with you now, you mongrel!
When Jim Deere and Darling left for a weekend, Aunt Sarah came to stay with the baby. And much to Lady's dismay, Aunt Sarah had brought along her two Siamese cats. They were troublemakers from the start. One cat headed right for the canary cage, while the other tried to make a meal out of the goldfish. Lady chased after them and spoiled their plans, but not before the cats had made a shambles of the living room. Aunt Sarah came running.
Merciful heavens! Look at this mess!
The two pesky cats pretended to be hurt. Aunt Sarah cuddled them.
Did that wicked dog attack you, my innocent little angels? Well, I know how to take care of that ruffian.
Aunt Sarah didn't waste a moment. She grabbed Lady and marched right down to the local pet shop.
Clark, I want a muzzle. A good, strong one.
The shopkeeper strapped a heavy muzzle onto Lady's face. It was so tight that she could hardly open her mouth. Lady wiggled out of Aunt Sarah's arms and bolted out of the store in fear. Up one street and down another she fled, trying to escape the horrible muzzle. She soon found herself lost and in a very bad part of town. Three big dogs spotted Lady and gave chase, snarling and snapping, until they had her trapped in a blind alley. As the snarling dogs inched closer to Lady, another dog leaped to her rescue. It was Tramp. Single-handedly, he fought the vicious dogs and sent them yelping away. Then he turned to Lady.
Hey, Pidge, what are you doing on this side of the tracks? I thought you... Huh? A muzzle? Oh, you poor kid. We've got to get that thing off. Come on.
Tramp led Lady to the city zoo. At a pond, they found a beaver struggling to pull a heavy log into the water.
Pardon me, friend. It looks like you need a log puller. I happen to have a handy-dandy one here, modeled by the little lady. Just nip it off and it's yours.
The beaver quickly nibbled through a strap, and Lady was free of the hated muzzle.
Come on, Pidge. Let's find a place to celebrate.
Tramp seemed to be known and welcomed everywhere they went. He had a different place to eat every day of the week.
It's Wednesday, Pidge. That means we go to Tony's restaurant. You'll love it.
Tony had a plate of bones all ready, but when he saw that Tramp had brought a lady friend, he served them a delicious dinner of spaghetti and meatballs. Then Tony took out his accordion and sang a beautiful love song while Lady and Tramp dined by candlelight. Lady marveled at Tramp's carefree life, so different from her own. After the romantic dinner, Lady and Tramp walked through the park to the top of a hill overlooking the city.
Look down there, Pigeon. There's a great big world out there with no fence around it, where two dogs like us could find adventure and excitement.
It sounds wonderful, Tramp, but... who would watch over Jim, dear, Darling, and the baby?
You win, Pidge. I guess we're just too different.
As he escorted Lady home, Tramp noticed some hens sleeping in a yard.
Hey, let's wake up those fat, lazy biddies.
But won't we hurt them, Tramp?
Nah, we'll just stir them up a bit. It'll be fun.
Tramp raced into the yard, barking wildly. Chickens went fluttering and squawking about until the owner rushed outside with his shotgun.
That's the signal to get out of here, Pidge.
All right, that was side one of Walt Disney's Lady and the Tramp. Of course, you're listening to Storytime with Chris Earle. Here on WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. And that's on vinyl. Yep. That is on vinyl, everybody. I normally do watch this from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday nights. It's a movie show, but today I decided to bring story time back for you. It's a little surprise for the fall schedule. The fall schedule is officially in order right now. It's in effect. It started up this week, this Sunday. So the fall schedule is up there on WMFO.org if you're looking for your friend who has a show or a show that you might have... listen to before. The entire schedule is up there, and also you can go on the archive and listen to shows such as this one. It'll be in the archive a couple hours later, probably around 8 o'clock. You'll be able to get story time. You'll be able to listen to all of these stories. I got, I don't know, 4 or 5 stories for you within the next couple of hours. I got a couple of Disney ones, and I pull up a couple of eclectic things. And I might even read you a story of my own here with some background accompanying music. I hope you are enjoying this 80-degree day. It's probably one of our last that we have toward the ends of September here, and welcome back to everyone here at the Tufts University campus who's back in school again. My name is Chris Earle. I am a middle-aged man playing a radio show for you. That's who I am. 855-915-WMFO is the request line. Going into my 11th year here on WMFO, did time travel. I did the sucking in the 70s. I did sleeping through the 60s. I did the big 80s. And I did story time and watched this, of course, plus some other shows along the way. Today you got story time. I got some great stories for you. Let's listen to what happens in the second half of Disney's Lady and the Tramp here on WMFO in Medford. So far, nothing's happening. What's happening here? Is it caught in a groove? Side two? That's what happens when you use vinyl, everyone. Here we go.
Sad on with.
What a bitch.
The lady tries, but dog bound. The dog darted, but dog bound. Keep up with Tramp as he.
Trying to get you the first word there. Come on, baby. We got dog pound. All right, we might have to check in. We might have to change this. Oh, boy. That's what happens when you have stories. Story time, everybody. Story time with Chris Earle. Yay. Yay! 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 Here we go. Yes? No? We don't know?
She chained her to the dog.
His side too, Lady and the Tramp.
Lady tried to keep up with Tramp as he darted around corners and scrambled over fences, but soon she was lost again. Without warning, the city dog catcher pounced on poor Lady and carted her off to the dog pound.
That Tramp! I never would have guessed he was the type to desert a lady.
Lady had never been so scared and humiliated in all her life. The dingy pound was full of sad, scruffy dogs who stared longingly at her license. They told her that it was her ticket out of there and wished they all had one, too. Soon, Aunt Sarah arrived to take Lady home. But as punishment for running away, she chained her to the doghouse. Poor Lady was feeling lonely and sad when Tramp came trotting into the yard.
Hi, Pidge. I heard what happened. I came over to tell you how sorry I am.
You ran out on me and I took the blame. It was so embarrassing. I never want to see you again. Goodbye.
As Tramp hung his head and turned to leave, Lady spied a big, ugly rat climbing into the baby's window. She tugged on her chain and desperately called for help.
Tramp, hurry! There's a rat in the baby's room!
Tramp raced into the house and up the stairs and burst into the baby's room. The rat was creeping toward the baby's crib. Tramp pounced on the rat and killed it. The noise from Tramp's fight awakened Aunt Sarah. She rushed into the baby's room.
Oh, you vicious brute! Trying to attack the baby!
Aunt Sarah hadn't even seen the rat. She forced Tramp into a closet and locked the door.
Now I'll call the dog catcher and have that brute taken away.
Jock and Trusty watched as Tramp was locked in the dog catcher's wagon.
Well, Trusty, there he goes off to the pound. I was certain he was no good the moment I first laid eyes on him.
Yeah, but I never thought he'd attack a helpless baby.
Just then, Jim Deere and Darling returned home. Lady gave a desperate tug and broke her chain. She ran into the house, barking frantically at Jim Deere.
Look, Darling. Lady's trying to tell us something. What is it, girl?
Lady raced upstairs to the baby's room to show Jim Deere the truth.
Oh, my goodness! Darling, come here!
What is it, Jim? Oh, a rat!
That means that Tramp is actually innocent. He saved the baby. But now he's being taken to the dog pound to be destroyed.
When Jock overheard this, he felt ashamed.
Trusty, we've misjudged Tramp badly. We've got to rescue him.
The two dogs raced after the dog catcher's wagon, barking fiercely. The frightened horses bolted. The wagon overturned, and the door sprang open. Tramp was free. Jim Deere and Darling were so grateful to Tramp that they bought him a collar and license. Now he was part of the family. The next Christmas, Lady and Tramp celebrated with their own family. Four adorable puppies.
Skies, they have stars in their eyes on this lovely Ballinorte. So take the love of your loved one, you need it about this time to keep from falling like a star. When you make that dizzy climb, for this is the night and the heavens are right on this lovely Ballinorte.
Wow, you don't get that anymore. Lady and the Tramp, From 1955, it's Walt Disney's story of Lady and the Tramp, the 24-page read-along, book and record. I like how Bella Notte and the Siamese Cat song were on there at the end. That was kind of a surprise. I was playing the story, and then I'm like, oh, these two from the songs from the film are in there. I'm like, that's kind of nice. Well, this is story time with Chris Earle. Normally, I do watch this, but we do have a lot of stories that are based on movies today. If you're looking for Watch This, I will come back with Watch This next week with a guest. But I'm going to do stories today for you. I might even read one myself. But I got some great stories coming up, including this one. This is more of a modern tale. Maybe not to you people here at Tufts University, because you would have been maybe, 8 years old when this came out. This is the tale of Iron Man here on Story
This is
Time.
The story of how Tony Stark became Iron Man. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear this sound. Let us begin the story now. Anthony Tony Stark was an inventor, genius, billionaire, and American patriot. After Tony graduated from college, his parents, Howard and Maria Stark, were killed in a terrible accident. Tony was left in charge of their multi-billion dollar technology company, Stark Industries. Stark Industries was well known for its development and manufacturing of advanced weapons and defense technologies. With his unique, brilliant mind, Tony quickly stepped up as chairman of Stark Industries. He invented countless weapons and received numerous awards. Although Tony was a sharp businessman, he couldn't run the company on his own. He hired an assistant, Pepper Potts, who kept him organized and on schedule. Obadiah Stane, a friend of Tony's father, stepped in as Tony's mentor and business partner. Tony enjoyed building weapons and showing them off, but he didn't enjoy the formal events that came with his new job. When he received the esteemed Apogee Award, Tony decided to skip the event. He sent Obadiah to accept the award for him.
Well, I'm not Tony Stark. but if I were Tony, I would tell you how honored I feel and what a joy it is to receive this very prestigious award. The best thing about Tony is also the worst thing. He's always working.
After the award ceremony, Pepper confronted Tony in his lab.
You are supposed to be halfway around the world.
Tony was supposed to be in Afghanistan, presenting his new Jericho missile to a group of high-ranking military officers, alongside his friend and the military liaison to Stark Industries, Lieutenant Colonel James Rhodes. But Tony just smirked at Pepper.
I thought, with it being my plane and all, that it would just wait for me.
Tony packed up his equipment and hopped on his personal plane. In Afghanistan, he presented his newest technology to Rhodes and the group of military men on a ridge that overlooked a vast expanse of mountains.
Is it better to be feared or respected? And I say, is it too much to ask for both? With that in mind, I humbly present the crown jewel of Stark Industries' Freedom Line.
Tony signaled toward the mountains and a large missile launched into them. The blast from the impact was so powerful that it blew all the men's hats off. Tony's audience praised him, and they headed back to the base. But as they were driving, a huge explosion hit Tony's truck. When Tony woke up, he was in a dark cave with a man who called himself Yinsen. Tony took in his surroundings. Then he looked down. There was a round metal device in the center of his chest, right over his heart. He shot a look at Yinsen.
What is this?
Yinsen explained that Tony had been captured and imprisoned by the terrorist group that had caused the car explosion. The shrapnel had wounded Tony. The metal piece in his chest was an electromagnet keeping him alive. Suddenly, a menacing man named Raza walked into the cave and demanded Tony build him the Jericho missile. But Tony was never one to be bullied.
I refuse.
Raza immediately summoned his gang, who forcefully dragged Tony outside the cave. Raza showed Tony that he already had all the equipment Tony would need to build the missile. He wanted him to start work immediately and promised to free Tony once the weapon was delivered. Tony didn't believe a word Raza said, but he knew he had to build something. Back in the cave, Tony started assembling, welding, and deconstructing the equipment he was provided. He threw a metal piece behind him.
Okay, we don't need this.
Yinsen realized that what Tony was building did not look like a missile. Tony pointed at the work in front of him.
That's because it's a miniaturized arc reactor. I got a big one powering my factory at home.
Yinsen was very interested in the arc reactor. He wanted to know the details, how it worked, and what it would generate. Tony enthusiastically explained.
If my math is right, I don't know as is, 3 gigajoules per second.
Yinsen realized that meant the arc reactor could run Tony's heart for 50 lifetimes. Tony shot Yinsen a sideways glance and smiled.
Or something big for 15 minutes.
Tony pulled up a blueprint in the cave. It showed his plan to build a metal suit with the arc reactor in the center of its chest plate.
This is our ticket out of here.
Yinsen believed Tony and decided to help him build the iron suit. For the next few days, Tony and Yinsen worked on the armored suit around the clock. Finally, it was ready to be fitted. Tony stepped into the suit and repeated Yinsen's directions to sneak out of the cave. He had only one shot at getting out.
41 steps straight ahead, then 16 steps, that's from the door, fork right, 33 steps, turn right.
With a few last-minute adjustments, the suit was activated, and Tony escaped from the cave. Raza's henchmen immediately confronted him, but Tony held up his arm, ready to fight.
My turn.
In his new armored suit, Tony took down Raza and his men using fire blasts from his arms. Then he rocketed away from Raza's headquarters. But his suit ran out of power, and he crashed in the desert miles away, where a military helicopter eventually found him and picked him up. Tony was welcomed back by Pepper, Obadiah, his supporters, and several news reporters at a press conference. He addressed the group with his usual wit and charm.
I came to realize that I have more to offer this world than just making things that blow up. And that is why, effective immediately, I am shutting down the weapons manufacturing business.
The crowd went wild. Cameras snapped and reporters yelled out questions. The news of Stark Industries no longer making weapons was a huge deal. Outside the press room, Obadiah confronted Tony. He was concerned about Tony's new decision regarding the business, but Tony stood by it.
We're not doing a good enough job. We can do better. We're going to do something else.
Like what?
I think we should take another look into arc reactor technology.
Tony opened his shirt and showed Obadiah his own arc reactor.
It works.
Tony didn't listen to Obadiah's objections and started working on his new initiative, a bigger and better iron suit that would save lives. For this, he consulted his other assistant, an artificially intelligent computer system named Jarvis.
Jarvis, you up? I'd like to open a new project file.
Till further notice, why don't we just keep everything on my private server? I don't want this winding up in the wrong hands.
Tony worked day and night on his project, spending all his time in the lab with Jarvis. Things got a little tense, and Tony snapped at his computer assistant.
Okay, I'm sorry. Am I in your way?
Pepper grew concerned. She went down to the lab to check on Tony.
I've been buzzing you. Did you hear the intercom?
Tony stopped working, looked up, and reassured Pepper that he was fine. He was just busy building his new suit. Tony's armor quickly progressed. Soon he had a powerful iron suit with an onboard weapons system. It still needed something to make it look sleek and cool. He rubbed his chin and called out to Jarvis.
Tell you what, throw a little hot rod red in there.
Next, Tony concentrated on the jets in his boots and the repulsors in his gauntlets. He wanted his suit to fly.
Activate hand controls.
Tony successfully hovered, but without warning, he was thrown across the room. Test unsuccessful. Nothing could stop Tony. He worked harder than he ever had before, and it paid off. He perfected the repulsors in both his gauntlets and boots. He lifted the suit off the ground.
Yeah, I can fly.
Then he looked over at Jarvis with a grin on his face.
Sometimes you gotta run before you can walk.
The roof of his lab opened, and Tony swiftly took off into the night sky. He maneuvered the suit like a pro. He arrived back at his lab. As he went in for a landing, he called out to Jarvis.
Kill power.
But instead of setting down gracefully, Tony smashed through three floors and into his garage, finally crash landing right on top of one of his flashy cars. While Tony continued to improve his suit, he discovered that Obadiah had betrayed their friendship by selling weapons to Tony's enemy, Raza, and bribing Raza's terrorist group to take Tony's life. Tony felt angry and guilty that his weapons were being used to harm others. He flew to the village in his shiny red and gold iron suit, armed and ready to take out the bad guys. When he arrived, he immediately started hitting them with his repulsors, sending the villains crashing into walls. With a final blast from his gauntlets, Iron Man took down the last bad guy and heroically looked up at the villagers.
He's all yours.
Then he headed back home. But Tony didn't know that while he was taking down Raza's henchmen and saving the village, Obadiah had hired his own scientists and was secretly working to create an enormous and powerful iron suit of his own. Obadiah instructed his team.
Set up Sector 16 underneath the Arc Reactor, and I'm going to want this data masked. Recruit our top engineers. I want a prototype right away.
He specifically directed one of the scientists.
William, here is the technology. I've asked you to simply make it smaller.
He wanted to build his own iron suit to get rid of Tony and take over Stark Industries. Since Tony knew Obadiah was up to no good, he sent Pepper to hack into his computer and find out exactly what Obadiah had planned. Tony soon realized he was going to have to fight his mentor and friend. He looked up at Pepper.
I'm going to find my weapons and destroy them.
Pepper shook her head.
Tony, you know that I would help you with anything, but I cannot help you if you're going to start all of this again.
Tony was upset.
There is nothing except this. I just finally know what I have to do. And I know in my heart that it's right.
Decked out in his red and gold armor, Tony took off. Tony lured Obadiah, who was suited up as the Ironmonger, to the top of the Stark Industries building. He wanted to fight him somewhere no innocent civilians would get hurt. As he attacked the Ironmonger with his repulsors, he shouted commands to Jarvis.
Divert power to Chestert.
Obadiah slammed Iron Man to the ground and stood over him.
Nothing's gonna stand in my way. Least of all, you.
Tony once again instructed Jarvis.
Take me to maximum altitude.
The two iron giants threw each other around until finally Pepper overloaded the large reactor in the lab below them, unleashing a massive electrical surge. The Ironmonger fell into the exploding reactor and was destroyed. The next day, at a press conference, both reporters and members of the public had a lot of questions about Stark Industries and the iron suits they saw battling in the night sky. One of the reporters referred to the suit as Iron Man. Tony thought for a moment and turned to his friends.
Iron Man, that's kind of catchy. It's got a nice ring to it. I mean, it's not technically accurate. The suit's a gold titanium alloy.
Then Tony became serious and addressed the press.
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
As the room went wild, Tony Stark grinned. He had learned that it was necessary to protect the public. And as the invincible superhero Iron Man, he would do just that.
Yeah. There's Iron Man. Iron Man the movie, the story.
This is the story of how Tony Stark became Iron
Man. Take it easy. I already played it. Why don't you, come on. Ugh, story time here with you until 7 p.m. Iron Man. Movie was from 2008, but this book came out in 2016. It's a CD and storybook. Narrator was a guy named Nolan North with the voice talents of Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, and Jeff Bridges, Tony Stark, Pepper Potts, and Obadiah Stane. What a great last name, Stane. That used to be a derogatory term back in the 80s when I was growing up. You call somebody a stain. You'd be like, hey, you stain. Stain. It last into the 90s? No, not really. I was like, hey, you stain. Douche used to be a good one. And then they added douche bag. That's one that's still kind of a hit. But people don't call each other stain anymore. People used to call each other Nazis, too. Just be like, Nazi. Anyway, story time. Here with you until 7 p.m. There's kids' stories. There's some adult stories. And let me just play a PSA for you, and then I'll be back with story number three here. It's story time with Chris Earle on WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts.
This is Alec Baldwin. There are lots of ways to show you have style. Wearing fur isn't one of them. Each year, millions of animals are drowned or beaten to death in the wild, or gassed or electrocuted in captivity for their coats. Cruelty is one fashion statement we can do without. Please help the animals by joining People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
To find out how you can help, visit furisdead.com or call
757-622-PETA.
Yeah.
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Kosher.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
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 Can you be any more specific?
Yeah.
You're darn tootin'.
91.5 WMFO.
Medford.
End of story.
And people complain about the Boston accent. Ugh. People in Fargo. Ugh. God. That accent's horrible. All right, on to story number three. You might recognize this voice. You might recognize this man. We've been hearing about him for years and years and years, and his story is slowly, slowly coming to an end because he's always in the news. It's always bad news, but you know what? He was America's dad for the longest time, and being a stand-up, he was pretty damn funny. Chocolate cake here. I'll tell you who it is after the story. Story number three here on Storytime with Chris Earle.
My wife woke me up 4 o'clock in the morning. She said, I want you to go downstairs and cook breakfast for the children. And I looked at the clock. I said, dear, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. She said, exactly. Go down and cook for the children. They have to go to school. I said, yes, but to eat at 6 o'clock, isn't that bad for your stomach? I mean, they just ate 12 hours ago. My wife said, Bill, get out of that bed and go downstairs and cook breakfast for your children. And I said, well, I don't know what they want to eat. She said, it's down there. Now you'll get out of the bed. I said, but where are the pans? Do we have pans to cook with? She said, Bill, I'm not talking to you anymore. You ask another stupid question. So help me God, I'll get the shotgun out of the closet and blow your face off. So I said, well, there's no need to become violent about this. You seem to be having trouble intellectualizing on where the cooking apparel is. So I fell back to sleep again. The next thing I knew, there was a bucket of ice water being shaken over my head. And this woman that I've been married to for some 17 years was standing over me like this. Now you get up and cook some breakfast or you're gonna wear this bucket of ice water. So I said, you're serious, aren't you? So I got up. Needless to say, I was angry. And I went downstairs without putting on my robe. Standing there in my pajamas, and I'm talking to myself. I said, get these went out and cooked breakfast, but it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I slammed the pans down. Blam! On the stove, and slam them down, and go to the refrigerator, and look around and get the damn bacon and the sausage! Cooking breakfast, 6 o'clock, blam! In the morning, and I grabbed it. You have to be careful with eggs. Cooked breakfast, and boom! Turn around. The first one down was a 4-year-old. The child looked lovely. Cute, little face clean, hair, little braids, little things, you know.
Come on, darling.
And I said, what do you want for breakfast? The 4-year-old has the ability to see through and find the wrong thing. And the child saw through my body what was behind me. She saw the chocolate cake.
And she said, can I have the chocolate cake?
And I said, chocolate cake where?
She said, chocolate cake behind you.
And I looked. And there was chocolate cake. The child wanted chocolate cake for breakfast. How ridiculous. And I said, and someone in my brain looked under chocolate cake and saw the ingredients. Eggs. Eggs are in chocolate cake. And milk. Oh, goody. And wheat. That's nutrition. What do you want?
That's a chocolate cake.
Chocolate cake coming up. Sliced it for her and served it. Now, you need something to drink with the chocolate cake. Something breakfast. Grapefruit juice. This is not your child. So I give the child a glass of grapefruit juice, chocolate cake, nutrition, eggs, milk, and wheat in the chocolate cake. And I didn't have to cook. And the other four came downstairs. And when they came downstairs, those of you who have children, you've seen them come downstairs for school. And they got to the kitchen. And they saw the 4-year-old eating chocolate cake. And they said,
Dad, where did she get the chocolate cake?
And he went to the child and said, how did you get chocolate cake?
He said, Dad, give me chocolate cake.
And they looked at me and they said, Father. Could we have chocolate cake? And their father said, chocolate cake, coming up. 4 slices. And grapefruit juice. And 5 children sat at breakfast. And the morning music was playing. And they were eating chocolate cake. And singing songs to me. That is great. Give us the chocolate cake. And we had a ball until... She came down like this. And when she saw what the children were eating, I've always heard about people having a conniption. But I've never seen one. You don't want to see them. My wife's face split. The skin and hair split and came off of her face so that there was nothing except the skull. And orange light came out of her hair. And it lit all around. And fire shot from her eye sockets and began to burn my stomach. And she said, "Where did they get chocolate cake from?" And I said, "They asked for it." And the children who had been singing praises to me lied on me and said, "We asked for eggs and milk, and Dad made us eat this." And my wife sent me to my room, which is where I wanted to go in the first place.
There he is. It's Bill Cosby. You might recognize him from the news lately, but back in 1984, he was on top of the world. That was from Bill Cosby himself, and right before he started doing the Cosby Show and became America's dad. And, of course, he's going to prison. Sorry, Bill. You messed up. You messed up. But it is what it is. He was a great comedian. His work is still out there. If you can get past the point that you don't like the guy, listen to his stand-up. There it is. I've been listening to people talk about Bill Cosby for years now. There's a little back for you. Bill Cosby himself with chocolate cake. Damn funny. Story number four here. Let's talk about the U.S. presidents with William Howard Taft. This is from a book called American Presidents here on Storytime. Here we go. Anytime. There we go. Let's start that over again. Let's do it clean. From the book American Presidents, from the National Portrait Gallery down in Washington, D.C. You ever want to go down to Washington, D.C.? Oh my God, is it fantastic. Go to all the museums down there. So much fun. William Howard Taft was our 27th president from 1909 to 1913. William Howard Taft initially was determined to follow in the footsteps of his predecessor, Teddy Roosevelt, in the implementation of domestic reform, but Taft, an indecisive leader, was largely unsuccessful in meeting this goal. When the president presented his tariff reform package, Congress put forth more than 800 amendments that essentially made the reform impossible to pass, and Taft did nothing to object. However, he did achieve one significant piece of reform legislation. It was the Mann-Elkins Act of 1910, which regulated destructive competition and unfair trade practices. In addition, 99 trust prosecutions were conducted while Taft was in office. Nevertheless, by the halfway point of his presidency, around 1911, he had become heavily influenced by conservative businessmen who criticized the effects of trust busting on the national economy. In the end, Taft reversed his position on tariff reform and therefore alienated progressives who viewed high tariffs as the worst offending characteristic of trust. William Howard Taft, born in 1857, died in 1930. And if you go to the National Portrait Gallery, you can see a picture of the fattest president we had. Oil on Artist Board by William Valentine Chaville. That's it. It's America's Presidents. Not much of a story, but you get to learn about the presidents today here on Storytime with Chris Earle. Let's go back to the Disney vault. I'll cue this one up for you. One of my favorites. They used to have the Magical World of Disney on in the 70s, and this one would play every so often, I think. I don't remember. 46 years old. How am I supposed to remember that? Anyway, story time here with you till 7 p.m. You want to call in 855-915-WMFO, and you want to hear a story of some sort, call on in and make a request, and maybe I'll get a story on for you. Who knows? Probably not, but maybe. If you're nice. Most people aren't, but if you're nice, maybe. Here's the story. A Davy Crockett.
This is a Disneyland original little long-playing record, and I am your story reader. I am going to begin now to read the story of Davy Crockett. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when Tinkerbell rings her little bells like this. Let's begin now. Davy Crockett was one of the best frontier scouts this country ever had. Many years ago, he and his friend, Georgie Russell, came from the mountains of Tennessee to scout for General Andy Jackson during the Creek Indian War. The Creek Indians were camped somewhere across the river. General Jackson wanted Davy to find out where they were and what they were planning to do. He sent the major and some soldiers along. Davy didn't want company. He and Georgie could do a better tracking job by themselves. They all crossed the river and quietly made their way through the brush. It was slow work, but it was the best way to get close to the Indian camp without being seen. The major got tired of crawling in the brush. When he came to a wide trail, he wanted to take it. Davy told him it was risky. They might be discovered. The major decided to use the trail anyway. A little later, Davy and Georgie heard war drums. They followed the sound and found the Creek camp. The Indians were getting ready to go on the war path. "Let's go back and find the major," said Davy. They backtracked through the brush and heard shots. The major was in trouble. He had blundered into a group of Indians on their way to join Chief Red Stick. He and his men were surrounded. "We'll have to scare them off," said Davy. He had a trick in mind. He walked some distance away from Georgie. "Company A, charge from the rear," he shouted. "Company B, advance," yelled Georgie, far away. The trick worked. The Indians thought the whole regiment had come to the major's aid. They retreated in confusion. Davy and Georgie stepped out from the bushes. "Where are the others?" asked the major. "Well," said Georgie, "two were enough." Davy and Georgie went back to the general and told him the Indians were preparing to attack. Following Davy's lead, the general and the regiment crossed the river and surrounded the camp. If they could capture the tribal leaders, the Indians would have to listen to reason, and a treaty might be arranged. Davy, Georgie, and some volunteers stole into the camp. They captured all the leaders except Chief Red Stick. Before they could catch him, two Creek warriors jumped Georgie. Davy took care of one of them, while Georgie fought the other. Then Davy saw Red Stick getting away and went after him. "Wait! I want to talk to you," he said. Red Stick wasn't about to talk to anyone. He gave Davy a clout on the head and escaped through the Major's lines. The Major and his men were busy reloading their guns and couldn't stop him. General Jackson knew there could be no treaty made without Chief Red Stick. He told the Major to take his men and go after him. Davy was to be the guide. "The Major and I don't quite agree on how to hunt Indians," said Davy. "I don't want any arguments," replied the General. And that was that. They went south, from the Smoky Mountains into Mississippi Territory and through the swamps, getting close to Red Stick but never quite catching up with him. Weeks passed. The Major and his men got sick. Finally, the Major decided to go back while his men were still able to march. Davy and Georgie went on alone. They picked up a trail going in two directions at once. They separated. Then Georgie saw some fresh tracks, whistled to warn Davy, and was hit from behind. When he came to, he was tied to a stake, with Red Stick's warriors piling wood for a bonfire. Suddenly, Davy stepped out of the brush. He challenged Red Stick to a fight. Red Stick agreed and picked tomahawks for weapons. Davy seemed awkward with the tomahawk in his hands. Georgie was afraid to look and closed his eyes. When he opened them, Davy had disarmed Red Stick and had him against a tree. "Turn my friend loose and go home," he said. "Sign the treaty, and I promise you the government will let you keep your land." Red Stick knew that Davy Crockett was a man of his word. He made peace. Davy and Georgie went home. Davy kept his promise. All his life, he did everything he could to help the Indians.
Nice job, Davy.